When the first sperm cell finally succeeds in reaching the oocyte, somewhere high up in the oviducts, there is a recognition reaction between the proteins on the front of the sperm and those on the oocyte's jelly-like zona pellucida. The recognition triggers the sperm cell to undergo its acrosome reaction, a rearrangement of membranes that makes the inside of the acrosome continuous with the outside of the cell. This lets enzymes in the acrosome reach the surface of the zona pellucida and to begin to digest it, allowing the still-swimming sperm cell to burrow through to the surface of the oocyte itself. Still assuming that this particular sperm has remained ahead in its race, it will undergo a second set of recognition reactions when it reaches the oocyte's plasma membrane. These allow the sperm and oocyte membranes to fuse, and the nucleus from the sperm, plus a few other proteins, to enter the cytoplasm of the egg. The rest of the sperm, its job done, forms no further part of the embryo. The one-to-many arrangement of sexual reproduction, in which a single oocyte is pursued by large numbers of sperm cells, creates a potential problem. Sex works when one haploid oocyte nucleus and one haploid sperm nucleus combine to restore the diploid state. The arrival of more sperm nuclei would result in triploidy, or quadruploidy, or however many ploidy, which we know is lethal. It is therefore essential that the oocyte lets in exactly one sperm nucleus and no more. It achieves this in two ways. The first is a very rapid change of membrane voltage triggered by the sperm's arrival. You will study membrane voltages in detail later in the course. The only thing we need to know here is that the change in voltage prevents more sperm fusing. It also causes the oocyte to release granules that harden the zona pellucida, making it shut any late arriving sperm out. Finally, the arrival of sperm triggers the oocyte nucleus to finish its meiosis at last. This second meiotic division produces two haploid nuclei, one of which is removed as a second polar body, while the other inherits the oocyte and conjugal rights with the sperm nucleus. The sperm and oocyte nuclei quickly break down, and their chromosomes line up for the embryo's first mitotic division. Despite what appears in many schoolbooks, they never do unite to make a single diploid nucleus in the zygote. Instead, they rush into the first division. All of these events take place under the control of sperm and oocyte themselves, with no need of special signals in the rest of the body. This is a clinically very useful fact, because it makes possible the technique of in vitro fertilization. This is done to help couples who cannot have a baby the conventional way. Typical reasons for this might be that the woman's oviducts, or the man's vasa deferentia, may have become damaged by venereal disease or perhaps by a previous sterilization operation, or perhaps they never formed in the first place. Also, it is possible that the man makes very low numbers of spermatozoa, or makes spermatozoa that are not capable of swimming. The technique can also be used to allow a woman to become pregnant using another woman's donated oocytes. The method was first achieved here in the UK by Steptoe and Edwards in 1978. There are now several variations on the basic technique, but it usually involves the following steps. First, the mother-to-be, or perhaps an oocyte donor, is treated with hormones to induce a large number of graafene follicles to form. When they are ready, keyhole surgery techniques are used to isolate them from the surface of the ovary. They are cleaned up of their surrounding cells and examined carefully. Sperm from the father are then collected, generally by the obvious method, which, being done in this context with the express purpose of begetting children, is generally considered acceptable even within religions that condemn the practice when it's used recreationally. If necessary, for example because of blocked ars deferens, sperm can be collected by needle from the epididymis or even by biopsy from the testis itself. The sperm are washed to remove dead or deformed cells and to remove inhibitors of motility. The washing medium effectively mimics capacitation of sperm, usually seen in the female reproductive tract. Sperm are then combined with the oocytes, and their early development is monitored, morphologically and sometimes genetically. One or more embryos that look to be healthy are then placed directly in the uterus of the mother-to-be. When the father's sperm cannot swim for themselves, they can be injected directly into the oocyte in a technique known as intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI. Whether done by people operating in white coats or people operating between white sheets, the bringing together of sperm and oocyte results in a cell containing the full amount of genetic material for a new human. What remains is the immense task of generating the relatively huge size and the extremely subtle anatomical complexity of a human body from that one cell. The process that achieves it is truly one of the wonders of the universe. One sine qua non of a complex body is internal difference, the presence of many specialized cell types, each suited to perform a different task. Having several different cell types cannot happen in a one-celled body, obviously, so it's perhaps not surprising that the first act of the young embryo is to undergo several rounds of cell division. These first divisions are unusual in that they're not separated by intervening periods of growth. This means that each cell division results in cells about half the size of the original, and the embryo becomes multicellular without growing at all. This type of division is called cleavage. Cleavage solves the problem of the embryo having enough cells to start making internal differences, but it does not directly create the differences themselves, for the cells inherit the same type of cytoplasm and are all the same. Creation of difference from homogeneity is a non-trivial problem. Technically, creation of difference is the creation of information, and information does not come from nowhere. Somehow, the cells of the cleavage stage embryo, which are all the same, must do something that they all do the same, that makes them end up different. The embryo's solution to the problem is very clever, for it manages to extract information from the rules of geometry. After the first few divisions, some genes on the embryo's chromosomes begin to be expressed. One specifies the production of an adhesion molecule, E-cadherin, and under its influence the cells clump strongly together. This clumping has an interesting consequence. Cells in the middle of the clump are surrounded completely by other cells. Cells that happen to find themselves at the edge, though, must have one free surface. This, the presence or absence of a free surface, seems to be the first signal that allows initially identical cells to become different from one another. The cells on the outside that face the free surface become the trophectoderm. When they bump into the lining of the uterus, they bind to it and start to divide, becoming the embryonic placenta. They also pump fluid inwards, inflating the embryo, which is by then called a blastocyst. Inside it, attached to the underside of the trophoblast at one point, are the remaining cells, a rather nondescript-looking blob called the inner cell mass. Every cell in your body now, except for your bacteria, came from this. Copyright statement. This audio essay by Professor Jamie Davis is to support the first-year MBCHB course at the University of Edinburgh. It is released under the terms of the GNU Public License. It may be distributed freely, but this copyright statement must remain with it, unaltered.